Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Jacqueline Rodriguez. Jacqueline is a SANE nurse, S-A-N-E, and the CEO of 4Med Insight. A SANE nurse is a sexual assault nurse examiner. She spent over 22 years working in the emergency room, with over 20 years of that time specifically working as a sexual assault nurse. At this point in her career, in addition to working in the emergency room, she consults in forensic and emergency medicine. She also works in investigations and conducts witness testimony. Her skills apply far and wide. She teaches her technical skills, as well as her communication approach, not only to other nurses and medical professionals, but to law enforcement and investigators as well. As awful as it is that her job is necessary, the lessons that she has learned communicating with victims and their families and law enforcement and other people involved in the process has positioned her very uniquely to understand how we need to connect with people, often in the worst of times, in order to get truthful information while we build trust, rapport, and establish bonds. So this conversation is going to take us in several different directions. She's going to talk about exactly what it means to be a SANE nurse. She's going to talk about the impacts of being patient-centered, the importance of being trauma-informed, because although the environment she works at, she's dealing with acute trauma consistently, we're all communicating with people who have trauma in their lives every day. She's going to talk about the power of giving people choices. She's going to give us some great examples of questions to ask. And I love her line that peacefulness is contagious. I think this is a very important conversation that we all can learn a lot from and apply to many of the conversations we have in our professional and personal lives. We really appreciate you being here for another week. Thank you. While you're here, take a moment. Please like the show, share the show, subscribe to it, leave us your feedback. We would love to hear from you sincerely. And take just a second to check out our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com. Check out all their resources, all their training. When you're ready, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training to recognize when people's emotions are shifting by identifying changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. That's over at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can get all your questions answered for both joining the International Association of Interviewers and earning your certified forensic interviewer designation. That's over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more, to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to unlock hidden value in all of their high impact conversations. We really appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so very much. So now, without further ado, we introduce to you Jacqueline Rodriguez.
Good morning, Jacqueline. It is so great to see you again. How are you?
Great. Nice to see you as well.
I really appreciate you carving out the time today, especially with all that you have going on. I know you are fitting this in, so thank you so very much. And for the listeners, I saw you give a presentation at an event maybe 6 months ago or so, something like that. I've been chasing you down ever since, so I'm glad you finally have the time to be here today. But I was really captivated by what you do, but also how you apply the lessons that you learn and the focus to people outside of your direct line of work. So to help give people a bit of an understanding of where your approach comes from and where your focus and perspective comes from, I'd like to ask by asking you to explain to us, what does it mean to be certified as a SANE nurse?
Sure, absolutely. So a SANE nurse is a sexual assault nurse examiner. And we are one kind of subcategory of forensic nursing as a whole. So there's all different types of forensic nurses. There's forensic nurses that work in death investigation, that work with victims of intimate partner violence, child abuse, elder abuse, human trafficking. You know, I think a lot of the areas that people tend to shy away from when we get into the nursing profession, because they involve a lot of trauma. So a SANE nurse is a sexual assault nurse examiner. So we have been specially trained to work with victims of sexual violence. maybe a pediatric, adolescent, or adult. There's kind of different categories of SANE nursing. And then we are the ones that get called in or come out when a survivor reports for medical services. We perform what's called a medical forensic exam, which can be a pretty intensive experience for the survivor. Sometimes it can last about 4 to 6 hours to do that exam. And we're with them throughout that entire process. So we get consent from them to do the care and provide the care. We take a detailed history from the patient, or if it's a child, we'll take that history from the parent or guardian. We perform a head-to-toe physical exam, a detailed anogenital exam if necessary. We offer them evidence collection kind of throughout the whole process. So whether that's, you know, collecting physical evidence from their body, clothing, photography, or even just the words that are coming out of their mouth can often be used as evidence in a trial. We then make sure that they're medically okay. So we might offer them medications or radiographic imaging, STI testing. And then we make sure that they're safe to go home. So we do a safety assessment and provide them with really thorough discharge instructions. So it's a very collaborative relationship between the SANE nurse and the patient or the family members, because really we want them to be making the decisions that are most appropriate for their body and for their life and what's going on with them.
I appreciate you walking us through that to start the conversation so we have an idea, and certainly thank you for the work that you do. You mentioned that you have specifically chosen to go down a path that many people would like to avoid. And, you know, from my background working with interviewers, even detectives that choose to go that route, you know, I've never done it, so I don't want to overplay it, but you know, there's trauma that you go, secondary trauma that they go through and that you go through and things that you're exposed to. But the heart and the care and the attention to detail and all those things, it's very unique. So thank you for dedicating yourself to helping the people who need it the most. I don't know how many people listening would think of like collaborating with patients. Collaboration is a word, my wife's going to jump all over me for saying this, that HR people throw around all the time, right? We need to collaborate more. But it really is, I could imagine a scenario where somebody comes in having experienced potentially the worst type of trauma, and the medical process could be re-traumatizing if we're not careful, even if we are careful, in any number of ways. So I know when I heard you speak, you talked about being patient-centered and trauma-informed. I've been in hospitals before, so I've seen how hectic and crazy it can be, even just with bells going off and people running around and trying to take care of multiple patients. And that's before the triage alert goes off and ambulances start rolling in and the plan that everyone had 5 seconds ago is now gone. So in your world, working in this chaotic environment, I guess we'll separate the two. First, how do you really focus on being patient-centered?
Yeah, I mean, I've been an emergency room nurse for 22 years, and I've been a sexual assault nurse examiner for 20 years now. So I just wanted to like put that in there because we talk about, you know, that secondary trauma, and you can't do this work unless you've figured out a way to take care of yourself first, right? And I think for me, that went right along with identifying how to provide patient-centered care, because it became so much less about what Jacqueline should do or what Jacqueline needs to do to take care of this person. It became, what does this person need from me? What does this patient need from me? And so when I really think of patient-centered care, it's taking the knowledge and the expertise that I have from so many years of being in this work, sharing it with my patient, whether they're there for, you know, even just like a simple laceration or abdominal pain, sharing the knowledge and expertise that I have, and then saying to them, what would you like to do? Right. And it's every step along the process of working with a patient, whether it is someone who's experienced trauma, whether it isn't someone, you know, they haven't experienced trauma, to be there. But it's just giving back that power and control to the individuals that we're serving. And I think once I identified that as a key aspect of the care that I was providing, it took a lot of that weight off of my shoulders of having to, you know, make all the decisions and be in charge and be in control of what was happening. I remember like very early on in my career, I would start doing something as simple as, you know, you're here for some dehydration, right? Like you need some IV fluids. Do you have a preference which arm I would put the IV in? And just that simple question, like you would ask people and their eyes would light up and they'd be like, oh my gosh, like no one's ever asked me that before. Yeah, I'm right-handed. I would prefer that it's in my left arm. Great. Would you prefer that it's in your hand or, you know, up in your antecubital area? Because if it's up in the antecubital area, you might not be able to bend your arm as much. And it's just those small steps, which really doesn't take that much more time, that I was able to, you know, just change that interaction with the patient from them being upset that, you know, the IV is in their dominant arm and then they can't move it to now they're like, I felt like I got to make decisions about my care. So to me, like, that's what patient-centered is. Like, I am basing everything that I do on the choices and the decisions of that patient that's sitting in front of me. And it's my role to give them enough information that they feel comfortable and confident in making those choices and decisions.
So many great things there. I would like to start by thanking you for teaching me the word antecubital. Did I say that the right way?
Yeah.
That's now my word for the day. I'm smarter now than I was 5 seconds ago. Thank you for teaching me that. But that concept of giving people power and control is so important, especially when they're stressed out. And anybody that comes to a hospital is going to be stressed. God forbid it's that far end of the worst trauma, or, I mean, it's all trauma, but difficulty breathing, a bad cut on my arm, whatever it is. Under stress, giving people that type of power and control shows how calm you are, how confident you are. That then becomes contagious. It builds, like you said, it builds their credibility. And I feel like there's a lesson there for everybody listening, no matter what your role is, from leadership to parent to business development to teacher to law enforcement to investigator, whatever it is, that I'm guessing that you are going to put an IV in that person somewhere, somehow, no matter what. Like, it was going to happen. But by you taking an extra 30 seconds to ask their preference, to give them a bit of an education and involve them in the decision-making process, they're now feeling as if they're in control. They have the power. You are truly collaborating. And that wasn't 30 seconds wasted. That was 30 seconds invested, because now the relationship you're building could likely lead them to share information with you that they otherwise wouldn't have. Instead of saying, I'm dehydrated. Well, I'm dehydrated because I haven't slept in 2 days and I've been drinking the whole time. And so now you're learning more from them than you would have. It was just, give me your arm. I'm going to stick an IV and get you hydrated. So those little things go such a long way. The phrase trauma-informed, and I don't say this disrespectfully, gets thrown around a lot these days in interviewing circles. And I think some people have the heart of what it means to be trauma-informed when they talk about it, and some people just put it out there because it's like a key term. But it is very important to understand what other people have experienced and how that can impact what they're thinking, feeling, saying, how they're behaving now. So from your expertise, I'd be grateful if you can help us understand what it really means to be trauma-informed when we're having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah. I mean, again, this goes back to, you know, even before my days as a sexual assault nurse examiner. I mean, 22 years in an emergency room, you can't imagine how many people that I've seen that have experienced trauma, right? Whether it's a car accident that they were in themselves, or people that even have witnessed a car accident. You know, saying to be trauma informed to me is acknowledging that every person you interact with on a daily basis has likely experienced trauma in their life. And the question then becomes, how has that trauma affected them? And how is that going to affect my interaction with them? I just think about like the environment of the emergency room as a whole. I'm comfortable in an emergency room. I've been there for 22 years, right? Like, I go in, I'm joking with my friends, we're drinking coffee, like we might have snacks at the nurse's station, like we're not supposed to. Like, we could be eating when something very traumatic is happening in the room right in front of us, and we don't even blink an eye about that, right? That is going to be a very different experience than most people who walk into that, just even the physical environment of the emergency room. And so I have to acknowledge that the exposure that I've had to trauma is not the same as the exposure that everyone else has. And so starting from the beginning with trauma-informed care, it's creating an environment and a space where people feel safe and they feel comfortable. You know, even if they have just experienced a sexual assault, for example, I need to create a welcoming environment where they know that with me, nothing's going to happen to them. And they can talk to me and we can work together to get done what they want to have done in this safe space. And then I have to acknowledge that even though they're presenting for like an acute sexual assault, well, that doesn't mean that they haven't experienced other trauma in their life as well. You know, we know the statistics for women who are first sexually assaulted again in their lifetime. So how could that previous traumatic experience also be affecting the care and the service that I'm going to be providing today? We find it a lot too with children that we care for sexual abuse, that a parent or guardian has experienced a traumatic event before. And so I think, you know, my response to trauma-informed care is just that upfront. Again, everyone has experienced trauma, and that if people react a certain way to me, it might have been because of something that happened to them. And not to take it personal, but to just be really open and have good communication and say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry I made you upset. I'm so sorry I said something like that. Can we talk about that? What happened there? What can I do differently in the future? Because again, when it comes to taking care of other people or even interacting with other people on a daily basis, I mean, you see people walk around all the time that are short-tempered. Where is that coming from? Like, what has happened to them? And how has that affected then their response to other people? And so I think it's just giving a little bit of grace to not taking everything personal when people respond or react to you, but just taking a deep breath and saying, I don't know what's going on in their life. Maybe they just had something really horrible happen to them. And let's kind of work through how we're going to communicate from now on.
Again, all great points. And I imagine for you and I, and even for people listening, it's hardest to not to take things personally when we're genuinely there to help, to lead, to guide, to inform, to support. Okay, if I showed up to kind of be a jerk that day and they're mad at me, maybe I don't take it as personally because I knew I was showing up to be a jerk. So that was the reaction that I expected. But when I'm here because I genuinely care and I'm taking time out of something else I could be doing or someplace I could be, or I'm here dedicating myself to help you, to teach you, to lead you, to guide you, whatever it is. And maybe I say or do something you didn't like and you react. That's when it's the hardest not to take it personally, I would imagine, for most of us. But yet the most important to step back, and I'm going to steal a word you used earlier, not the last one that you taught me because I probably can't say it right again, but acute. Hey, if I would imagine in the environment that you work in, because the trauma they come in with is often acute to some degree, right? They were in a bad car accident. They got a broken arm hanging off the side. Their face is covered in blood. They were experienced a sexual assault. Something very obvious and very significant just happened. So the need to go, oh, I do need to slow down. I do need to help them feel calm. I do need to earn their trust. I do need to collaborate. It's a little bit more real because it's right there in front of you. But for many of us, it's not. People come to work, they show up to a meeting. If, you know, maybe you have to sit down and interview somebody, they didn't know they were going to be interviewed that day. So to be able to step back and say, whatever this person has experienced in their life is going to set their mental models, their expectations, and that's where they're going to communicate from is really, really important.
Yeah. And I mean, I have a personal example on this one. I used to have a manager in the emergency room that every time we got called in the office, you were getting written up. Like you were in trouble. And I then left the ER for a little while. I went to a corporate job. And anytime my director would call me in, like I would start having anxiety about walking into her office. And we were like, obviously we had much more like in office meetings in that situation because it was a business, you know, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. So she was calling me in her office frequently. And I finally just said to her one day, I was like, if you could just put in your email to me what we're going to talk about, And like, I think our conversations will go so much better because my previous experience was when you got called in, you were getting in trouble. And I said, so that's still in the back of my mind. And just that little thing, like that was me acknowledging like the trauma I had experienced and then being able to communicate that to her to say, oh gosh, okay, this. And from that point on, she was like, hey, can you come in to talk about, you know, the budget, or can you come in to talk about the next product rollout or whatever it was. And then I would walk in and I'd be like, okay, let's talk kind of thing. And my whole mood changed. My whole behavior changed with her. Like, even like sitting down, like I would come in like this very closed posture, like almost like a little turtle, like hiding in my shell. And I think that, you know, even in the business world, we don't know what people have experienced, whether you're interacting with a security officer, whether you're, I mean, think about interacting with law enforcement. I tend to speed a lot. I get pulled over. I know my response to law enforcement is always very defensive. They don't like that very much, right? But that's something that I have to like take in control and be like, okay, be nice. Maybe they won't give you a ticket this time. So I think like no matter what interactions we're having with other people, even business environment, healthcare, law enforcement, you know, people come with previous experiences, some of which may have been traumatic for whatever reason. And we don't know that. So it's just that assumption. Everyone has experienced trauma and we don't know how it's going to affect them.
And when I saw you speak, I seem to recall you had like a chart with different types of trauma and different levels of trauma. And I certainly wouldn't ask you to quote the whole chart. Don't worry about that. I can't even remember it. But it surprised me when you, and I might not be using the right words, but you had like primary trauma and secondary trauma and things that, and obviously at the top of the list, and that's maybe not using the right words for your specific chart, but the top of the list would have been things that we would all assume is trauma, right? But then the bottom of the list were things that I might have just thought of previously as like a tough day or a tough week and not really trauma, but over time it really affects us. So I'm not going to ask for every example, please, I promise. But could you help us understand kind of the range of trauma that people can experience to sort of level set how we think and interact with people in some of these interactions?
Yeah, so I think you're referring back to the adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah, I think so.
Table that I was talking about. So the Adverse Childhood Experiences study was a study that was done many years ago, but has now been repeated. And what they did, this is done out in California, what they did is they looked at individuals and asked them if they had experienced these 10 like broad categories of childhood abuse or neglect or household dysfunction. And then they kind of tracked them over the next 20 to 30 years. And they were able to see that for individuals that had experienced more adverse childhood experiences, they had higher rates of heart disease, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, obesity, just a lot of like diabetes, hypertension, stroke, like long-term health consequences. And so when we think about those ACEs, there's the three categories. There's abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction. So abuse is physical abuse, emotional abuse, or sexual abuse. I think those are all, you know, usually pretty evident to people. Emotional abuse is a little bit harder to pick out than the others. And then there's neglect, physical neglect or emotional neglect. Again, that emotional piece can be a little bit harder to pan out. The household dysfunction was the big things, like living with someone with a history of mental illness or a mental illness disorder. Having a relative that's incarcerated, having a mother who experienced intimate partner violence, substance abuse in the household, or divorce, right? Like even divorce being one of those things, that about 50% of the population has at least one ACE. It's those groups that get up to the three or four ACEs where we start seeing those real long-term health consequences associated with it. In terms of the ACEs, though, like those are the big categories. We also just have like historical trauma, right? We have racial bias that still exists. We have things like lack of health insurance for people, or even lack of health literacy, right? Like they may be going to a doctor, they may be seeing a doctor and getting a diagnosis, but they're not understanding what that diagnosis means. And then we've got those health conditions that pile on to, you know, hey, I've been diagnosed now with diabetes, but I don't have enough money to pay for my insulin or pay for my medications. So now I'm having these other health complications associated with it. So I think a lot of them actually like kind of feed into each other. And we don't know about those little struggles that everyone has on a daily basis. There's a video I've often played when I'm doing training that shows a man with like a pile of shoes in front of him. And he walks up and he tries on someone else's shoes and he lives in their life for a minute. And then he's like, whoa, steps back, goes to another pair of shoes. And there's just a couple of them that like really hit you quite hard because it's walking through this other person's life by putting their shoes on from when he was a child and his parents were arguing in the household. And then he was being physically abused to later on where someone's spouse has died and he's expected to go into work and still take care of the kids. But no one knows that his spouse just died and has been buried, you know, so I often think about that is, can I put myself in someone else's shoes? And I can't. Right? Like we can never understand, but can I be patient? Can I be kind and just acknowledge that they may be having a really bad day and it's nothing that I can see on the outside, but that shouldn't change how I react to people and how I respond to people. I tell my kids all the time, you can only be in control of your own behaviors, right? So if someone's being short and they're snapping at you or they're being rude or, you know, whatever, kill them with kindness because we can't know what they've been through. We can't know what they're going through and we can only be in control of ourselves.
Again, all great points. And you totally just set me up to ask you about one of your favorite quotes from when I saw you speak. So thank you for that. But let's take it back to the ER for a second. I imagine when we talk about controlling our reactions and controlling our behavior, when I think selfishly for me, when I think about that, it's like it's an outcome-oriented experience. So if I can stay focused on my job, the outcomes I'm looking to create here, then I can do a better job controlling my reactions and my behavior. But if my emotions overwhelm my focus on my outcome, then I'm more likely to say or do something that I'm probably going to regret and apologize for and maybe have to go buy donuts for my son or something like that after the fact. You had a quote that, if I recall correctly, I believe I heard you say that peacefulness is contagious. And I loved it when I heard you say that. So if we take it back to the chaos of the ER, and I'm always fascinated by people who just are so calm and so functional and at their best in chaotic environments, which if nothing else, the ER is that. So in your experience, I would be grateful if you could walk us through, what do you mean by peacefulness is contagious and how do you employ that philosophy in your role?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, working with anyone in the emergency room, but especially sexual assault patients, like I know that they're coming to me because they've just experienced an acute traumatic event, right? I don't walk in all hyped up being like, oh my gosh, what happened? Are you okay? Like, that is just going to like do, do, do. Sometimes, you know, sometimes law enforcement is there when I get there. Sometimes friends or family members are there and everyone is just like on high alert, right? Like we need to get this person. We need to do this. We need to, you know, pitchforks on fire, like go get them kind of thing. And I just kind of walk in and say, you know, just sit down, introduce myself. Say, you know, I'm so sorry to have to meet you in this situation, but I'm glad that I get to be the person who's here with you as we walk through this journey, right? And it's my tone, it's my body language, it's my appearance, right? I'm not walking in with like hot red lipstick on, like I'm very just neutral and soft-spoken. And I don't always get that same reaction back from my patient. They're like, let's go. We need to do something. We need to do it Absolutely. And I'm here to do whatever you would like to have done today. But I think it's helpful if we start with a kind of an understanding of what this process is going to look like and start going through some of your options and choices, right? And I feel like that level, when you bring in that level, which is not intense, it is not, you know, jumping with the pitchforks, people come down to you, right? They start to mimic your tone. They start to mimic your energy. We know that after a traumatic event, people can have a flood of hormones that occur in their body. Sometimes I walk in and my survivors are very like monotone. They're very unemotional because that's the flood of hormones that they experienced. So sometimes I do have to like bring the energy level up a little bit. But for the most part, people are, you know, had a flood of the catecholamines, the fight or flight hormone. And so it's like, okay, you're safe here, right? Like reinforcing those things, but also showing them and demonstrating that. I mean, if you've ever had small children, right? When they start throwing a temper tantrum, if you go right back at them, it is just out of control. And so I mimic it with my children too. Like if they're throwing a temper tantrum, I get down to their level. I sit down next to them and just calmly say, what's going on? I'm right here. What do you need? Right? I'm not going to say I do this 100% of the time, but we try, right? Yeah. We try to like mimic that. We try and bring that peacefulness in to show them like peacefulness is also your ability to regulate your behaviors and your reactions. And it's contagious. It is. It really is.
It's so true. And I love it. I love it. And the kid example is great. I have a young son. And I agree. My wife probably does it better than I do. Let's be honest. So I can speak for myself. I probably don't do it right every time, but certainly try to take a similar approach. And I also laugh. There is plenty of things that work with my 7-8-year-old son that also work with adults, and plenty of things and reactions 100%. That I see adults do that I see my son do the exact same thing. So there's a little more correlations between how kids act and adults act than we might want to admit on an average. But I love everything that you just said. I'm a full believer in that you could, with your tone, your body language, even the pace that you enter the room, the first words that you choose, all of those things, it sets the tone, it brings them down. I couldn't agree more. I'd like to ask a follow-up question because you talked about law enforcement being in the room. You talked about family being in the room. And without, thankfully, having never been in one of those rooms, I imagine that often law enforcement might be in a protector slash problem solving mode. So my job is to protect this person that just got hurt. And my job is to go get the person that did it to them. And I need to do that as fast as I can, which is their job. Like, I don't say that with any negativity, but that can put them in a particular controlling, maybe dominant, maybe less than listening mindset. And I can imagine that family members might be in a similar mindset, either one kind of overcaring, overprotective, or like you said, pitchforks out on fire. If you don't give me somebody right now, I'm going to go get someone in the parking lot anyway. So when you walk into that room from an outsider's perspective, I think, okay, you're in charge because you're the one that's leading the examination. The examination is going to lead to the evidence that allows everybody to hopefully get to some legal degree, the justice that they're looking for. The legal system limits the amount of justice we can actually get in some of these. I'll keep my personal opinions out of it. So when I finally get to the question I wanted to ask you here, how, with your peacefulness is contagious approach, how do you work to, and I say in air quotes for people who are just listening, control the room by not being the dominant person?
So I actually learned this from watching too many TLC shows. if you've ever seen an episode of Say Yes to the Dress, where
I can proudly say I haven't.
They've got the bride that comes in looking for her wedding dress and her entourage, right? Now, it wouldn't be a good show if everyone just agreed with the bride and the entourage was well controlled.
Yeah.
Oftentimes the entourage is what makes the show. Right. But what they do at every single time is they walk into that room and they say, who's my bride? And they focus on that person right off the go, right? That's what I do. As I walk and then say, who's my patient? Now, usually it's pretty obvious. They're the one that's sitting in the bed, but sometimes they don't want to sit in the bed. They want to sit in a chair, and I'll have three people sitting in chairs, and I don't know who's who because one of them might be an undercover cop, right? And so I'll say, who's my patient? And I will go straight to that person and have the conversation with them, introduce myself, and then I will look and say, now, who did you bring with you? So I'm giving them the power to tell me who these other individuals are and whether they want them to stay or not. Because after I say, who's with you? I said, okay, I'm going to just ask for a minute that everyone just kind of step out of the room. And they do. Again, that calmness, that I'm just going to ask you to step out for just a minute. And then I go back into the patient and say, I would love for you to have someone here to support you, but I want you to be able to tell me who that is and what that support looks like, right? Because sometimes they want, you know, for example, I'll have a teenage girl. Sometimes they'll want their mom as their support person. Well, mom is over here like texting on her phone the whole time, like, oh, I can't believe you did this and that. And, you know, there's other things that might have happened in the situation that mom is not happy about that they're focusing on now instead of focusing on my patient. And so I ask what that support looks like. And then we identify that person in the hallway and I say, okay, I'm going to ask you to come back in. The patient would like you to be their support person. To them, this means X, Y, and Z, right? So this is what they're looking for from you. Are you able to do that? Again, not knowing their previous trauma, I need to make sure that they're up for this role. The other people in the hallway, then I say, I'd like to take you guys to a private room. Just ask, you know, who you are, what your goal is here. And then we'll kind of figure out when we can bring you back in. So for me, a lot of it is the separation and creating that space. And although giving the full power to the patient as to who they want there, you know, a lot of times I do an exam, it's the patient, it's a rape crisis advocate, and it's a support person, and it's me. And I might have someone as an assistant in there for me as a chaperone, especially when I'm doing a genital exam. So there could be a lot of people in there, but we each have our roles and we each kind of know our roles before we go in there. Now, law enforcement, I will say I am so privileged to work in Illinois because we passed legislation back in 2016 that mandated training for all sworn law enforcement officers in Illinois on sexual assault. So our officers are well trained and understand this whole trauma-informed approach. They understand the patient-centered concept. Our relationship with law enforcement over the past 9 years has drastically changed for these patients. They're no longer there on the scene being like, we got to go get this guy. They understand that if we don't have a patient that wants to be involved with law enforcement or wants to participate in an investigation, that they just need to pause and take a deep breath and let that patient get to the point where they're ready to participate. Because, you know, rarely do these cases get prosecuted in the first place, but even more rare are you going to prosecute a sexual assault without the survivor's cooperation and participation, right? And I think like, with anything we do, we have to think about that. Like, what's the end goal? And can we get there without this person that's sitting in front of us? And if we can't, then we got to be on their page and we have to move at their pace and we have to do what they want to do, always giving them information and choices, right? So, I mean, I think the separation helps. I think again, communication about roles and responsibilities from the get-go helps, but then also just understanding like, what does my patient need? And am I delivering from the people that they asked for it to be delivered from what they're asking for?
So much gold there. It's not what I want. Here I am putting words in your mouth. I apologize. It's not what I want to do. Is what does my patient need? Maybe I have a meeting coming up. Maybe I'm supposed to be back at the station. Maybe there's a shift change. Maybe there's any of these other things going on that's coming up on my break. What does this patient need? We're going to work backwards from that. going directly to the patient, fantastic. Separating people, I used to get so mad. So long story short, I had a neighbor that lived across from me. He was in his 80s. We were extremely close. He was like a second father to me. And as his body was failing him in many ways, I was his primary caretaker. So I took him to the ER on multiple occasions. Now, I love this man. I took the best care I could. He was very involved. But I would take him to the ER. I would be sitting in the room with him. And the nurse would come in, ask what was going on. I would let Chuck talk. And then if he missed something I thought was important, I would fill it in. And then I would be sitting right there and she would turn away from him. And I'm not picking on one nurse. It would happen all the time. She would turn away from him, look at the computer, and she would read the questions. Do you feel safe? Is anybody abusing you? Is anybody keeping you from what you need? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yo, I'm in the room. Like, I'm not even his biological son. I should be the number one suspect. Why are you letting me sit here when I would get so angry? Like, you're not even looking at him. He can't even like wink and nod at me and be like, no, everything's fine except for that dude right there.
Yeah.
It used to upset me. So getting people out of the room, thank you so much. But the thing that blew me away was not just asking who you want in the room, because I think a lot of people might think about that, but what do you want from them? What support do you need from them? That is a tremendous question, because now you're learning more about the patient. You're learning more about the witness, for lack of a better word. You're learning about their relationship. It's putting you in a position to then educate the other person, which sets expectations. So now if they come in and they're not doing what's needed, it gives you the opportunity not to be the jerk, again, in air quotes, but to turn around and say, hey, remember, this is what we need. As opposed to stop doing that. That was, when you said that, I had all I could do not to cut you off and start clapping. Like, that is a fantastic question. It's not just who do you want in the room, but what type of support do you need from them? All the instructions, for lack of a better term, or instructions or introduction in any high stress conversation plays such an important role. Fantastic job there. Even knowing the team roles. Like, how many times, you might have seen this outside of the ER, like panel interviews, where people just don't know their job in the interview. So they're tripping all over each other and they're making mistakes and they're making people upset. Like, if everybody knows their role, especially in a high stress, not only are you more efficient, but you're more patient-centered. You talked a little bit too, I was going to feed it in there, but then I loved your question. So I'm just going to take a hard left turn here. One of the other things that I loved that I heard you say when I saw you speak was the importance of using neutral space. Can you help me understand what you mean by that? Because I think I'm on the right track and I think it's awesome, but I would love to hear it directly a little bit more.
Yeah. So in terms of space, just in general, most people, I think you're talking physical space is what I was talking about, right? Like, most people do not like to be within arm's length of someone that they don't know and are not comfortable with. And a lot of my work nowadays is with pediatric patients. I can't just walk in the room and sit on the bed next to the kid that's just been sexually abused, right? Like, that is close. They're going to be like, who are you and what's going on? But so I always, like, anytime I'm in a room talking with a patient, I'm sitting down. So I want to be in a space where they are at eye level or above me. So I'm lower than them, right? Again, it's that power dynamic. As a healthcare professional, I know that when people come to the emergency room, there is a little bit of power and control that I have, and I'm trying to give it away to them. So I sit down in a chair. I'm at least an arm's length away. I ask them if, like, where I'm sitting is okay. And at any point in time, I try and put my patient closer to the door than me, because I want to let them know at any point in time, you want to leave, you're allowed to. That's kind of a trick we taught with law enforcement too. Obviously, if there's a huge safety concern, I'm being closer to the door, but with most of my patients, there's not. It's just that sense of, like, they can see a way out and it doesn't have to go through me. A lot of our work, like, we don't do on computers. We purposely do it on paper. So I have a clipboard, I've got my paper in front of me. I ask them if it's okay if I sit down and take notes. It's much less distracting than if you're talking to someone and they're like clicking away on the computer keys. Like, that makes me crazy. And like, you can't hear them because you're clicking so loud. But it is, it's giving that physical space, but also the vertical space too. If I'm in a room with a kid and they have decided that they are going to, you know, sit on a chair, I may have to sit on the floor to be lower than them, right? If I'm talking to them and I stand over them, they're like, oh, I should say whatever she wants me to say because she's bigger than me. She's a grown up, those kind of things. So it's creating that environment of, again, the power and control shift from me to that other person. Anytime you're around someone that you're bigger than, you automatically feel a little bit more in control. So whatever we can do to change that space.
That is fantastic. Every single point you just made is critical. It's extremely critical in your line of work. It's very critical from an investigative standpoint. You know, all the rules that we used to follow, you never sit between them and the door. Try to sit in at least equal chairs, if not a little bit lower. Try to stay at least 4 feet or about 4 feet apart so you're not too close, not too far. All of these things that you're saying, that transition of power. I feel like for people who have power and control in a given context, there often, not always, but often is a need to reinforce that power. Like, I might lose it, so I got to remind them that I'm in charge. No, that power doesn't go away. You're the nurse. You get to make the decision. The last time I was in the ER, there was a man who was on drugs and was non-compliant, but he was in the room next to me, so I got to hear all of it. And I haven't heard words like that used in that string in a long, 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 long time. But I listened to the nurses give him every possible opportunity. And when he finally crossed the last line, the cops came in and he got strapped down and the nurses did what the nurses were going to do. Like, if you're the nurse, you're in control. What you want to get done is going to get done. If you're the doctor, if you are the manager, if you are whoever, like if you're the leader in the room, if you're the parent, like you don't lose control by giving somebody else more power, more choice, more space, more deference. Your power actually builds there because they're trusting you. They're building rapport. The hormones their brain is releasing is now different. Like, it's an entirely different reaction and interaction. Everything you said there is gold, not just for what you do and not just for investigations, but in any conversation. Like, I laugh when I walk into an executive's office and they're talking about they're having problems connecting with their people. Well, is this how you normally set up the conversation? Because they're sitting behind their gorgeous desk in their giant chair, and I'm sitting in a chair that looks like it came from my kid's classroom. I wonder why we're having this disconnect there. I know you do a lot of work training law enforcement. So I'm sure you do a bunch of work training inside the hospital as well, but with law enforcement. So I know you talked about Illinois in particular, which is where you are being much further along, unfortunately, than many other states based on the specific legislation. But I'm curious, as you begin to work with law enforcement, where some of these concepts may be foreign, may be different, maybe some of them with the best of intentions, I'm not talking negatively, feel like maybe it's counterproductive to, I need to get up and get this bad guy now before he disappears. If they're coming in with those mindsets, how do you work to influence and build trust and rapport with the law enforcement who you're training?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, right? Because there is a role and responsibility for law enforcement to do, you know, what you said, like to find the bad guy and to not let this happen to other people. I think I just remind them, you know, especially with sexual assault patients, I just remind them that what that person just went through is not anything any of us could imagine, right? It's a life or death situation. Someone has complete control over what's happening to your body. And nowadays we're seeing really increased levels of strangulation involved with sexual assaults because of the influence of pornography. I mean, that's a whole other conversation we could have. But truthfully, their life was in someone else's hands. Right. And I just asked them, like, if you were in that situation, would you want someone telling you what you should do? Because it's not, we know the prosecution rates are so low. If they wanted to make a police report, they would have gone to the police department. If they came to the hospital, they want medical care and attention. Just because I'm required by law to call you doesn't mean that you're required. That I'm required to give you access to that person. We know that if we support survivors and give them what they need, they will move forward with whatever course of action is right for them. And it's not one survivor's job to make sure that no one else gets sexually assaulted. If we really had a criminal justice system, that worked as well as it could, we wouldn't need survivors in order to move these cases forward, right? Because I could testify to what they told me. Their outcry witness could testify. You know, there are other things that we could do to put someone that we are concerned about being a rapist, because we know many rapists are serial rapists. Like, there are things that we can do to watch them, to make sure they're not doing this again, make sure they're not allowed to go to certain places. So I think it's just that, it's that reminder, right? Like, for most people, they're not going to get to trial. They're not going to get to a conviction, but they're going to have this thing that affected them for the rest of their life. And if we can make those small impacts for their medical care, for their health, for their mental health, then they will lead a more productive life as a survivor of a traumatic event. I've always kind of compared it for law enforcement, and I think, you know, some of them get it more than others, but like, we first learned about this option for delayed reporting for sexual assault survivors based on the research that was being done with law enforcement after police-involved shootings, right? That when officers were first involved in a shooting and then asked to give a statement, it didn't make any sense. It was all over the place. Things were jumbled. Now, the information that was coming out, everyone says, is accurate, but it wasn't in this chronological order that everyone really likes. That's the same thing that happens with a sexual assault survivor, right? It's a traumatic event. And so then researchers said, well, law enforcement should have 2 sleep cycles before they give a written statement after a police-involved shooting. Then it went up to 4 or 5 sleep cycles, because no matter what kind of traumatic event you're in, you have that flood of hormones. And they've even shown, you know, with the military, no matter how much training you go through, you don't get to pick your response to a traumatic event. So there's been lots of stories of military veterans in active combat that froze, that couldn't fire their weapon when they were being shot at, or when they're, you know, their partner was being killed. They froze. So if we can train our military for months, for years, on what to do during active combat, but we still can't guarantee that they're going to do it, what are we saying then to someone who's a sexual assault victim, who's never been trained? We don't get trained on what to do if you experience sexual violence, right? Their response is their response. Our response has to be understanding and knowledgeable as to what that was. And so it is just that, it's bringing everyone back to a reality of what is trauma, how does it affect us, and what is our role in supporting this person to heal from the trauma that they've experienced. Because I hope that's why most law enforcement got into their jobs, was to help people, right? And they can have such a bigger impact on helping victims than, unfortunately, the impact of putting bad people away.
Yeah, and helping victims starts with the victims. And that's true in any number of contexts, but most especially in the context that we're talking about today, it's got to start from them and work backwards. And all of the techniques and all of the approaches that you've talked about today, clearly it's what you've been trained on, it's what you train others on, it's what you do, unfortunately, all too often. But they apply even outside of that world. And again, I'm very grateful for the work that you've chosen to do and the people that you help and how you do it. And I'm also grateful that you took the time to share it with us today. Thank you so much. I know that you have training materials. I know that you teach training programs. So you have the work that you do in the hospital, but you have the work that you do outside of the hospital as well. For the people who are listening and they're hearing this maybe for the first time, or maybe they are involved in law enforcement or medical care and they're looking to learn more from you, how can people connect with you to continue to learn these critical techniques and approaches from you?
Yeah. So thanks. I have my own consulting business. It's called 4Med, like forensic medical. So 4Med Insight. The email is just formedinsightllc@gmail.com. I am up on LinkedIn. I haven't got quite around to creating a business web page yet.
We'll get you there. We'll get you there.
I mean, I've been doing the consulting for a year and a half now. I'm developing a training curriculum for another state for them to train their pediatric adolescent SANEs. I do national presentations, so I'm presenting at 5 different conferences this year, and then a lot of local stuff still here in Illinois. But I'd be happy to, you know, webinars, conferences, whatever you guys need. I think just this conversation of, you know, and again, I got pulled into this by a colleague that I used to train with about trauma-informed, evidence-based, victim-centered services, right? And we constantly saw that overlap between what I was doing as a forensic nurse, what he was doing as a detective trainer, and just being able to say, like, gosh, we all need these same communication skills and techniques. And I know when he pulled me in for the IAI conference at first, I was like, wait, I'm not talking to a room of police officers. Like, you have me talking to business people. And he said, yeah, just, you know, don't say sexual assault too many times, right?
We're all adults.
I know, but it was like, it was great for me to just like, again, see that overlap between these trauma-informed conversations, this you know, patient-centered services that I'm providing in the healthcare setting, and just how that crosses over into so many other aspects. And they're not hard concepts to teach, especially when you can put examples behind them. And people then start to realize like, oh, yeah, I can do that. Like, that's easy. And you hear people, my favorite part about training is hearing people come back to you months, years later. I remember one of our first groups that we did the law enforcement training here for in Illinois. That was a hard group. It was about 400 sworn officers in the room. And I got up there and talked about, you know, the sexual assault medical forensic exam. And about 6 months later, I was at a sexual assault response team meeting, and one of the officers that was in that room came up to me and he said, you know, I'm going to be talking today. And I was like, oh gosh, like I was a little nervous. And he said those three phrases, he goes, evidence-based, trauma-informed, victim-centered. He said, the first time you said them, I was like, oh, here we go. Here's a nurse trying to tell us what to do. He goes, but you know what? I gave it a try. And he goes, ever since then, my interviews, I've gotten more information than I've ever gotten before. He's like, I actually feel like I'm making a difference in people's lives by putting those concepts in place. And so I took like a nice deep breath after he like got up in front of everyone and said that. He's like, you know, it is stuff that we should be doing. And sometimes we need to learn from people outside of our profession that have more experience on it, or, you know, put it into action more. I mean, in the first 9 days of April, I got called in for 8 sexual assaults in 9 days. So this is still like an active practice that I am in, mentoring nurses, educating law enforcement. And I'm happy to help if there's anything I can do with any of your programs.
Well, I certainly vouch for you. I was at that session in Illinois, and I thought you did a tremendous job, not just with what you taught, but helping us as a, there were some law enforcement in the room, but a lot of us come more from the business side of the house, helping us understand what you do and while, you know, talking about what you do. So I thought you did a great job. So I certainly vouch for the work you do and for the techniques that you teach. And those words that you used, evidence-based, trauma-informed, victim-centered, like nobody should be surprised that you get more truthful information somebody when you let them feel like they're feel respected, they save their dignity, and they're in control of the conversation. Like that should be common sense. That shouldn't be a surprise for people. I can't thank you enough for everything that you shared today. I appreciate you taking the time, having the conversation with us. Thank you so much. I will include all the links to your work and the new website as soon as it's up and running, so people can find it right away. But again, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jacqueline, thank you so much for a very important conversation. Thank you for the work that you do, the people that you help, and the message and the techniques that you're spreading. It's terrible. We live in a world where these things are necessary, but thank you so much for what you're doing, and take just a little bit of your time to share it with us today as well. I truly appreciate it. To reinforce that comment you had about peacefulness being contagious is so very important. If we stay calm, we can bring other people to our level. For all of us, we don't get to pick our trauma, as we discussed, whether it's firsthand or secondhand. We don't get to pick it, but we do have to work with it. And the concept of deferring to others to get what we need done. Yeah, you're the nurse, you're going to get what you need done, but deferring to other people, giving them the agency, the control, the power, building the trust, so very important. All of the techniques you shared are not only critical in your very acute context, but in all of our context as well. So thank you so very much. And of course, thank you to all of you who took the time to listen today. We truly appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so much. Please, while you're here, just take a second, like the show, share the show, leave a comment, leave your feedback. We would really like to hear from you. Thank you. And of course, please take a quick second and check out our sponsors. Head over to humanintel.com. Enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice. That's where you get the best-in-class online training to recognize when people's emotions are changing by identifying shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. That's all over at humanintel.com. If you're a professional interviewer, go check out certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you get all your questions answered about joining the International Association of Interviewers and earning your Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Again, over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you'll learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more, to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to uncover the hidden value in all of their high-stakes conversations that leads to generating better outcomes and forging stronger relationships. We really do appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so very much. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.